Place, you see where we are. That's Glass, that's in London Crypto. I'm Josh Denilo. Over there is Brian Lamacchia, the clean shaven one. Next to him is John Manfredelli.
The dirty shaven one?
Right. Well, I can say that. We are going to be tag teaming things. It's a benefit for you because many instructors, there'll be many people to talk to and ask questions of. Another benefit of this, I'll start getting into the logistics, but after tonight, we expect that at least one of us will be at the remote site in Redmond. Hi, Redmond. So we'll sort of be facilitating, and we'll be in both places, and we'll try to make this work well as a distance course. I should say a little bit about logistics. We're a little bit behind on the web page. You may have noticed that the default web page is up and nothing else is up. It's the first day of the new year in practice. We just got our accounts cleaned up and set up. So everything's being taken care of there. We'll get the syllabus up, the course information sheet, and the first assignment up, presumably tomorrow. Assuming there are no glitches, it'll be tomorrow, and there shouldn't be any glitches, especially in the first assignment. That's one logistical aspect I want to talk about a little bit. The course is going to have essentially weekly homework assignments. What we'll do is something that may be a little unusual, but it's worked well in the past. It's been very effective, and that is as soon as we collect the homework, you'll have homework given out essentially after a class, or hopefully very shortly after a class. It might be tomorrow instead, but do the next week. And as soon as you hand it the next week, we're going to go over it. We're going to spend the first 10, 15, maybe up to 20 minutes of each class just going over the assignment that you just turned in.
So turn in paper copy at the class.
Turn in paper copy at the class, although if you want to turn in an electronic copy, it's fine to turn it in electronically. You can send an email. We'll give you information, that part of the information. We've got the TAs are assigned. We'll get the email addresses out for questions, and we'll get pointers for where you send homework if you want to send in homework. That's fine. It's probably easier on paper for you. There will be times when people won't be here, want to view the lecture remotely, whatever, mail in the homework, that'll be fine substitute. We'll probably just print it and put it in the pile of the paper homework, but that's okay. The reason that we do this immediate turnaround and answers is that seems to be the only time that people really care. You just spent the previous evening, maybe the previous hour, trying to finish up these problems, figure out how to do it. At that moment, you really care about how to do it. If we wait till the following week, I don't remember this stuff, it's gone. You know, if we hand out answer sheets, okay, well, I got my grade, this is all I care about. So, this what some people like to call a teachable moment. This is a time when you might actually care about how to do this and really be paying attention. And I don't want to waste any of those. I don't think any of us want to waste that. So that's how we'll be working homework. But there's an obvious corollary of this. Since as soon as the homework is due, we are going to be talking about the solutions, it means there's really no opportunity for late homework. Late homework is just not going to be an option. Now, I think that's actually a good thing, because it makes you keep up. If you have a terrible week and you're behind, you just didn't have enough time, you could only do three of the five problems or whatever it is, turn in those three problems and you're done with it. You're done, you see how to do the problems, you move on, you go on from there. That's a lot better than getting to week nine and still be working on homework from week five, trying to catch up. So the idea is you just stay up with things and you do the best you can. We'll be available for questions and try to give help, but definitely turn in your homework on time and that'll be it. The end of the course, most of the grade will be the homework. The end of the course, we still need to discuss a little bit and get your input on. But there are two possibilities, a final project of some sort or a final exam. The final project is logistically a little bit more difficult because there are a lot of people in this class. But I think there'll be ways to make it possible. Actually, we're not going to make a decision now. We'll work it out in the next few weeks probably. But maybe just a straw poll at this point. And I'm watching Redmond also. How many people would prefer a final project to a final exam? Okay? Non-scientific straw poll. Looks like a majority so far, but how many people would prefer a final exam? Okay, so there seems to be a majority, but not a huge majority for final projects. That's good to know. And again, non-binding, we'll figure it out in consultation with the class. A couple of other things. We don't have any formal required course textbook. We will be working out of class discussion, but there are resources that are useful. And we'll post all this stuff also when we actually figure out how to get the web page straightened out. But there are some very good textbooks. There are many textbooks, some very good textbooks. And I'll mention a few of them. So let me reach down out of camera's view for a moment and pick up a few possibilities. One of the best books, and the thing we most recommend, if you're interested, is the Handbook of Applied Cryptography. This is by Menezes, Van Oorschot, and Vanstone. We'll put all the references up. This book has a real nice benefit besides being a very good book. It's not so much a textbook as a reference book, but it's got a lot of information, a lot of good information. But one real benefit it has is if you just do a Google search for Handbook of Applied Cryptography, you will find yourself quickly, should offer MSN search too, I'm sorry. Do a search for Handbook of Applied Cryptography, and you will find yourself at the web page of the first author. And on the first author's web page, there's information about the book, including sample chapters from the book available for download. The sample chapters available consist of every single chapter in the book, as well as the index and the table of contents. So, you should feel free to visit the webpage. It is the author's webpage. This is nothing pirated. Go to the author's webpage and download whatever sample portions of the book you find interesting. This is definitely a good way to get the material. It's a book worth having, so I'm not going to tell you don't buy it. It's a nice handy book to have. But there is an easy resource there. Okay, a few other books that I will mention is a very popular book, and I'll emphasize that is the adjective describing it. This is a very good book. This is a very popular book. Is Applied Cryptography by Bruce Schneier. It's very popular in part because it's a very easy book to read, and it's a very good way to, you can pick it up and start reading through it and really get a good feeling that you understand crypto and understand what it's about and how it works and everything. It's very good for that. If you want to actually build anything, do not touch this book. It has many errors. Again, to Redmond in particular, I want to emphasize this. When I go into somebody's office to work with them on something and I see the book, this book on the shelf, that's an alarm. We may have a problem here. Because it's got a lot of oversimplification, many errors, whatnot. It's very easy to read this and think you understand it and miss all the subtleties and make a mess. But still, it's a good resource to get a good high-level view of things. Another book I will mention.
Question?
Yeah.
Are there any particular parts of that book that you would warn us about?
Pages 1 through 500, roughly.
It was one of the first books where I go, wow, this kind of makes sense,
It makes a lot of sense. But if you try to build things, you get problems. So I'll mention just a very small anecdote. It'll take a minute for an anecdote. There has been a lot of recent work on what are called one-way hash functions. And we'll talk a lot more about this later on. Not tonight, but don't worry, this is an important topic. Discovering collisions in hash functions. And one of the more important hash functions, more commonly used, was MD5, very commonly used hash function. A Chinese team found out how to get a collision. And they came to a major crypto conference and reported on this work. And other people couldn't verify their collision. It just didn't seem to work. And people who checked it carefully went through and found that they'd gotten the initial value constants out of Bruce's book. And Bruce had big Endian, little Endian backwards. They implemented it backwards. And they had to get it fixed. They were able to find a collision once they got that straightened out. Their work was fine. But effectively, one of the most significant contributions of this book is it delayed the breaking of MD5 by several months because they thought they had it. And they had some bizarre variant thereof. Now, another book I want to mention, Practical Cryptography by Ferguson and Schneier. Same second author. Different primary author. And even in this book, it is admitted that this book has probably done more damage than good. people tend to think, okay, you can read this book and you're set. This is a really good book. Niels Ferguson, the primary author of this, is in Redmond. We're lucky, we might even get him to do a guest lecture. It would work well because 10 isn't divisible by 3, but 9 is. So maybe that'll be a way to make things work, but we'll see. Yeah. Niels is pretty busy. He's got a 4-month-old, very cute newborn. And, I don't know what I want to impose on him. I put these down. There is one other book I'll mention when I get back into camera view, and that is... I've forgotten the title of Stinson's book.
Cryptography Theory and Practice?
Cryptography Theory and Practice. I didn't bring it because the copy that I have that I work with is a preprint copy. It's sort of pages in a notebook, and holding up my notebook with no real cover doesn't do anything. But Stinson's, Cryptography Theory and Practice is also a good book and a good resource. And again, it'll all be on the webpage. We'll point all this out and make it available. But this way, I give you a little bit of context about which of the books we prefer. Start with the handbook. It's a good place for reference and material. We're not going to be covering any of these books straight through beginning to end. In fact, a lot of what I'm going to be talking about tonight is chapter 14 of the Handbook of Applied Cryptography. I think there are only 15 chapters. And one of the nice things about cryptography is you don't need a lot of background to jump into this. You don't need a lot of prerequisites. We don't have any formal prerequisites for this course. The only thing that we like people to have is a certain amount of mathematical sophistication. Not a huge amount, but... yeah, there'll be equations from time to time. We will have arguments, maybe even a proof, maybe sometimes some theorems, some facts, whatever. We're not going to get too heavy into that. The course, practical aspects, and there is emphasis on practical, but we are going to be talking about some of the theoretical parts also, so we'll get both of it. Okay, are there any general questions before we get going into actual content and material? No, none out in Redmond? Is this gesture irritating? I feel like I'm looking out in the wild yonder. Okay. All right, so if we're going to get into this course, we might as well figure out what it is that we're talking about. Crypto is an interesting area, lots of surprising results. I think that's the easiest way to move slides. got to do with a lot of things, but the basics that we can talk about might be, and there are a lot of other applications and fundamentals, but protecting privacy is certainly an important aspect of crypto and data security, which is also an important part of this course. Authentication of various kinds, knowing who you're talking to, having assurance that you're communicating with whoever you think you are or you want to be. Maintaining integrity, making sure that what you're seeing is what you're supposed to be seeing and not something that's been changed somewhere, making sure everything stays legitimate. Basically, the synopsis of what crypto is what you do, protocols that you use, in environments where you don't have complete trust. Okay? If everybody trusted everybody, if everybody were completely honest, there'd be absolutely no need for crypto. There'd be no need for you to be sitting here, and we'd live in a nice paradise, and utopia would be great, and we'd all be eating grapes or something, I don't know. But that's not the world we live in. And this stuff is really important and seems to be getting more important constantly. Right now, if you look at what's happening on the web, security is a major component of things. Lots of advertising now about various products is we're better than they are because we're more secure. We've got better security, supposedly. At least people are starting to care about this a lot. And I think for good reason. There are risks. And this is how you protect yourself against many of the risks. Okay, let's see. Is there an easy way to advance this? I guess that's the easiest way. So here are the characters that you might find in crypto land. I'm missing, because of this presentation software, I don't have my nice animated slides. You don't get to see Alice, my carefully constructed drawing here, walking onto the page the way it's like. But that's okay. You get an idea of who Alice is here. So you might have Alice, you might have Bob. These are the two normal victims. And you would likely have a situation where Alice is talking to Bob. That's sort of a standard cryptographic scenario. They want to have a conversation. Now, there may also be a third party involved in things. And Eve may be listening to Alice talking to Bob, and you may want a situation where Alice and Bob can communicate privately without Alice overhearing what's going on. They know they're talking to each other. They know it's not Alice on the line that's intercepting the stuff, overhearing in any way. They're having a nice private conversation. So this is a pretty simple, standard three-party scenario. And a lot of cryptography is around sort of three-party scenarios. A is talking to B or doing something with B, reaching some agreement, having some communication with B, and there is an adversary out there. Might be an adversary that controls many resources, many things, but sort of everything else can be lumped into the adversary. That would be standard. Some cryptographic applications are more than three-party, many more. One thing we might talk about a little bit if we have time is how to do elections, where every party, you've got millions of parties to an election protocol, and how to do a real good, verifiable election protocol where everybody can see that their vote is properly counted. This is possible. I'd love to talk about it if we have time. But I want to dial things down a little bit and instead try to make things a little bit simpler. So here's a three-person scenario. Let's go down and talk about a two-party scenario. You can still have a lack of trust even in the two-party scenario. Alice and Bob may want to do something. They may want to agree on something, but they may want to do it in such a way that they're both confident the other one isn't cheating. Forget about Eve. There's no outside adversary. Their partner is potentially an adversary. And this is pretty much as low as you can get, right? You can't really have one-party cryptography, but you don't trust yourself. I can't help with that. It's two-party. Even if you're encrypting your own data for protection, that nobody else will ever see, then it's you and the rest of the world is the adversary. So there's no real one-party crypto. But we can talk about a two-party environment, a simple one like this. And I'm going to start out with an example. It's not used a lot in practice, but it gets a little bit at some of the nature of what can be done with crypto, because there are a lot of surprising aspects to it. There are a lot of things that happen that are unexpected, that you might think can't be done, and it's an interesting place to start, I think. So let me pose a problem, and we'll see if we can get anywhere with it. So Alice and Bob want to flip a coin, but they're not in the same place. They agree that they want to make this decision by flipping a coin, and they don't necessarily trust each other. And let me just give you a little bit of motivation for this scenario. It happens a good deal in sports, but in particular in baseball. There are often playoff games at the end of the year. Those of you who are nearly as old as I might remember 10 years ago, the Seattle Mariners had a playoff game here. And there's got to be a decision. Two teams end the season tied. There's going to be a one-game playoff to see who goes on. Well, how is it that it's decided where that game will be played? The answer is by a coin flip. And what happened 10 years ago, and what happens really every year, but in that particular case, is representatives from the Seattle Mariners and representatives from the then California Angels flew to New York to flip a coin. Now, you know, there were other teams going to flip their own coins too, but you know, you would think, you know, even in 1995, there was something called the internet. There was email, there were telephones. You know, maybe we can do better than this. Maybe we can flip a coin without being face to face. But do it. And you don't want to get into the situation of, okay, I'm flipping the coin. You go ahead and call it. Heads? Nope, it's tails. You lose. Sorry. We can do better than that. At least we hope we can do better than that. So let me see. I want to sort of get a sense for how we might do it and talk about scenarios, but I want to set some ground rules first. Because the first thing people say is, well, you do something at the same time, right? You know, there are all sorts of games where you've got two people, and one, two, three, you know, scissor, paper, stone, or something like that. And those work fine if you can guarantee simultaneity. But that's something that you can't really do in practice. Yes, let's send email to each other at exactly the same time, and we'll each say either A or B, and if we both say the same thing, I win, and if we both say different things, then you win. Well, if that works, it's fine, but you know, I might wait till I get your email, and then I'll send my email. I'll say, oh, well, it's just network delays. You know, so trying to get simultaneity when you're not in the same place is very difficult, and really harder than flipping a coin. So since we don't have simultaneity, we're just going to do things where players take turns. First player does something, Alice does something, then Bob does something, then Alice does something, then Bob does something. That's the way of just saying, okay, we're not synchronous, so we might as well accept that and recognize that each player is doing something at a given time. With this, yeah, still doesn't seem like it should be that hard, but I don't know. Anybody have any ideas on how you might make this work? How you might flip a coin in this environment? Yeah?
I'm thinking of some public key encryption thing where Alice and Bob make their A and B guesses but encrypt it with the others.
Okay.
But I'm missing some details.
Well, yeah, I mean, week six, actually not. This you know, by the end of tonight, or probably by the end of next week, if not by the end of tonight, yes, we'll be able to see easy ways of doing that. I want to even ratchet it down. This is first principles. You don't have to know anything about public key crypto or anything to do that. Okay, I think I saw some. Were there hands in Redmond? Did I see? No? Okay. Is there somebody else here? No, everybody, oh, yeah.
I suppose that Alice is flipping the coin and Bob is making the guess.
Mm-hmm.
Alice needs to flip the coin and encrypt the flipped value and pass it to Bob. He doesn't have the ability to decrypt yet, but he's got it captured, so she can't change it afterwards. Then, at some point, the key has to come after that.
Everybody's trying to apply crypto. For some reason, they think this course is about crypto. I don't know. But yeah, something like that can be made to work. You have to be careful about choosing your cryptographic method, because there are some uses of cryptography where you can have multiple keys, and with one key, it'll decrypt one way, and another key, it'll decrypt another way. Just because it's encrypted doesn't mean it's fixed. But I'm going to do something, you know, way down. Forget about any sophisticated encryption. Let's try to keep it as simple as possible. So, the first thing I want to do is look and ask the question of whether or not this is possible. And because you might think, you know, there's some drawbacks. And then once we get past that, we'll start looking a little bit more deeply. So there's a two-part answer to the question, is this possible? Okay. First part is no. The ground rules I set are too tough. I won't give you a formal proof, but I'll sketch out why this can't be done. Then,
yes.
Part two, yes, I'll tell you how to do it. And, you know, we'll reconcile this. I won't leave you in you know, such disconcerted shape at the end of this. But a lot of cryptography actually has this. There are very subtle differences in assumption things that turn something that's impossible in one context to something that's very practical in another and can actually work quite well. And there are a lot of surprises like this that come out in crypto. So hopefully we can have a little bit of fun with something like this. So what I'm going to do first is show why this can't be done. And what I'm going to do to start with a flow tree of the protocol. And what this is representing is, and I guess I can try some of the magical pen stuff here and see how well this works. Things start up here at the root A. Okay, that work? Everybody can see that? Good. Okay. A makes a move. And A has four choices of possible moves. Right here, 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 and here. Okay? Might be a very wide tree. Maybe A has 1,000 moves. But A has some finite number of possibilities that Alice can do at the beginning. And then, after Alice makes her move, Bob can make a move. Okay? Here, Bob has three choices. 1, 2, 3. Etc. Two choices here, three choices here, and it goes on from there. Okay? So it goes on and on, and eventually you'll get a conclusion if this protocol is going to work. Well, we're assuming to start with that such a protocol exists, so eventually you'll get a conclusion. So, eventually, at each leaf of this tree, you will get somebody who won. Okay? At this leaf here, B won. This says you got to there, B must have won. This says you got here, A must have won. B, A, etc. Okay? Now, it is possible that you get into an infinite loop. So there might be branches that just go on forever. If it stops, there's got to be a winner. Otherwise, you know, you finish the protocol, it's a tie, who cares? It's very easy to see how you can get an infinite branch. I'll give you a game, a protocol that's a version of this. Okay. We each say heads or tails, and whoever says tails first loses. Okay? I'll go first. Heads. Somebody want to? Anybody?
Heads.
Heads. Okay, heads.
Heads.
Oh, tails. I'm tired of this. Okay. But, you know, that's a game where you'd have an infinite path in this tree. But it's a completely uninteresting game. It's not going to solve your problem. Okay? So, let's see. What can we do, assuming we don't have any infinite paths, because they're not going to produce anything good. We've got a finite tree. Every leaf is labeled. Then we can start looking at what happens. So, let's take a look here at sort of some pruning that can be done. suppose you get to a point where you're here and everything below you in the tree is A. No matter what move is made, whether it's Alice's move or Bob's move, the conclusion is going to be Alice wins. Then you might as well not even make that move. You might as well just, you know, when you get to that point, say, okay, Alice has won. I won't bother with the last move. The game's over. Similarly, down here, you know, if all the possibilities lead to Bob's winning, the game might as well be over at that point. Bob has won. Okay? What about these possibilities? Suppose that here we've got a case where Alice has a turn, and one of the moves will cause Alice to win. And the others might cause Bob to win, or Alice to win, or some long thing to happen, whatever. As long as this is the case, Alice is going to make the move that wins. Right? And down here, Bob is going to make the move that wins. Right? There's no reason not to. So, we've now got some rules that allow us to prune the tree. Okay? Look at the tree we've got. Down here, at the bottom, Bob's turn. Here, well, Bob has a winning move, so, you know, let's get rid of that and just make it Bob wins there. And down here, Bob's turn. Well, Bob again has a winning move, so we might as well just get rid of that and put a B up there. Okay? And we keep on going. Again, you're not seeing the nice, cool graphics with this, but you get the idea. So you keep on going. Here, it's Alice's move. Alice has a winning move, so Alice would win. That'll be A. And then up here, this is going to be an A. This is going to be an A. Well, this Bob is going to win no matter what, so there's going to be a B over here. Getting bored yet? Here it's Bob's move. Bob is a win. It's B. The only choice is Alice winning. Bob will win that one. Bob will win that one. And it's Alice's move, and one of the four possibilities leads to Alice winning. So Alice is obviously going to take this choice at the beginning, and Alice wins. So at this point, you prune the tree. Why bother playing the game? This is a game which Alice wins.
Or whoever starts it always wins.
Or whoever starts, yes. First player wins. Okay? So Alice is the first player wins. Why do we bother? Well, this is a general protocol tree. Any asynchronous protocol is going to follow a tree that looks like this. You can map it down to this kind of tree. So any game is going to be determined. Why bother? You might as well just figure out who's going to win and then you know, stop. But then you're not going to get a coin flip out of this. You're just going to be able to say, well, let's play the game where I win. No, let's play the game where I win. Doesn't do you any good. Okay, so pruning is complete. One will end up with either a winner before the protocol has begun, beginning, or that useless infinite game we talked about. Who says tails first loses, something like that. Okay, so now I've told you that this is impossible, but you probably are suspicious. Maybe you're more suspicious than others here.
Yeah, I was just wondering, this is assuming the protocol has no randomness in it, right?
No, actually, it's not assuming a lack of randomness. What I am assuming, though, is no outside sources. So if there is some sort of a trusted third party, then we could say, well, we'll let Charlie flip the coin and tell us who won, then it's easy. If Charlie provides some randomness, then it's easy because we'll say, well, we'll take the first bit that Charlie provides, and if it's a 1, I win, and if it's a 0, you win. So if there's an external source of randomness or any source, external source that's outside of this, then yes, you can do this easily. Another possibility is we'll count the number of words on the front page of the New York Times tomorrow, and if it's even, I win, and if it's odd, you win. You know? Probably neither of us can control the parody of the front page of the New York Times. You know, maybe you could do something really dramatic and get yourself on the front page of the Times, but actually causing the parody to have a certain value, that would be a trick beyond probably anybody around here. Maybe you can make yourself editor. I don't know. It'd be tough. Okay. So the assumption is that everything is internal. The entire universe is Alice and Bob. They can have randomness of their own. They can say, okay, I'm going to flip my own coins, and I'm going to decide on my move based on my own coins, but that's still matched by the trick. I still have, Alice still has a set of possible moves, and Bob still has a set of possible moves. Okay? Now, that said, you're still probably suspicious and think, come on, you heard about, you know, maybe you can use encryption or something else. This should be possible. Okay. Well, even though we've already concluded that coin flipping is not possible, and this proof, like, it was a sketch, but it can be formalized, it's time to show how to do it. So, let me give you a protocol. Fairly simple, but what I'll do is do some exploration. And what we're going to do is look at the integers, whole numbers. That term should be familiar with. So, I'm going to put down the whole numbers, but I'm going to write them with an interesting grouping. There. So, I'm just using positive integers. I could use, well, I'm using zero, I guess, but I could use negatives also. It doesn't really matter here. But I'm grouping them into four rows. Okay? And these four rows are pretty easy to see what the characteristics are. Right? Rows, the one and three, or whatever, the top row and the third row, are even numbers. They're all evens. The next rows, this row here, is all values which are one larger than a multiple of four. Right? These are all multiples of four up here. These are all one larger than a multiple of four. And these are all one smaller than a multiple of four down here. Okay? Now, I don't care about the even numbers. Now, let's stick in the world of odds. Odds are far more interesting. And see what we can do with these. So, I'm going to label these odds the type positive ones, the ones that are plus one above a power of four, and type minus one, the things that are minus one above or one below a power of four. Okay? Power of four plus one, power of four minus one. Those two types of odd integers are going to bisect the world of odd integers, and we don't care about the evens at all. All right? Now, a fact. Here's one of those equations. Not a bad one. If you've taken high school algebra, this is pretty easy to see. If you multiply two odd integers of the same type, the result will always be of type plus one. Right? You just multiply it out. Here are two odd integers, four something plus one, four something else plus one. Multiply it out, you get four times something plus one. Now, if you took two things that were one less than a multiple of four, you multiply it all out, you get four times something plus one, because the minus one here and the minus one here multiplied out, you got a positive. Either way, you get something of type plus one. Okay, yeah. Odd facts of integers. Do we really care? Why do we really care? Well, there is no known method other than factoring to figure out whether a type plus one integer that I've given you is the product of two plus ones or two minus ones. They are, you know, to me, I can't tell them apart in any way except by factoring. And small numbers you can factor. When numbers get big, it gets very hard to factor. This is going to be an important tenet of the class. We'll talk about it a lot more. Not usually. Don't worry about it too much. But it's an important tenet of public key cryptography that multiplying large numbers together is a relatively easy thing to do. If I were to give you 200-digit numbers and write them down on the board, this would be the final exam. Here are 200-digit numbers. Multiply them together by hand. You could probably do it by hand. You know, maybe it'll take you half an hour. And there's a very good chance you'll make a mistake, but it's not that hard to do. It doesn't take that long. And it takes a computer a tiny fraction of a second to do that perfectly accurately. No problem. Now take that product, 200 digits long, factor that, you know, take the combined computing power of the whole world, you're not going to factor that in my lifetime. Now, the current combined computing power. With Moore's Law, maybe we'll get up to factoring a 200-digit number. We're getting close to that now. But, you know, let's kick it up to 300 digits or so. We're still a long way from that. So, you know, this is something that we can take advantage of here. So factoring, I've already asserted factoring is much harder, or at least believed to be much harder. We don't know. We can't prove it. But as far as what we know, factoring is much harder than multiplication. So, come on. Hello. There we go. Given that, we can build a protocol fairly simply. So here's Alice and Bob. What Alice does is randomly select a bit. And for simplicity, we'll call the bit plus 1 or minus 1, instead of 0 or 1. And two very large integers, p and q, both of type selected by the bit. So Alice is saying, OK, I'm going to take two plus 1s, or I'm going to take two minus 1s. And she's randomly deciding between them, using her own randomness. And compute the product. Then tell Bob the product. Here's my product. It's a type plus 1. You know it's a type plus 1. Gives it to Bob. See, this cartoon's coming handy. Just to remind you what's going on here. Okay? And once Bob receives this commitment from Alice, this product from Alice, Bob then guesses. Well, I don't know. I'm guessing they're both plus 1s. And then Bob sends his guess back to Alice. Bob wins if he correctly guesses. Well, Alice wins if Bob is incorrect. It's fairly simple. Now, we want to finish this off. Alice has to prove that she wasn't trying to cheat here, so she sends Bob P and Q. So Bob can check. Yeah, they... You know, I did lose. They were both plus 1s, and I guess minus 1. Oh, well. I guess you win. I guess we'll play the playoff game in your city. Or, you know, you get to do whatever it is that you wanted to do for dinner or whatever the coin flip is about. Okay. So, we're set. P and Q are set over. There's the protocol again. There. So, just for practice, you know, let's try the game a little bit. So, you know, just quickly, I want to take like 2 minutes on this. And somebody here pick either two plus ones or two minus ones. They can be on this list. They can be a little bit bigger if you want. Multiply them together. We'll try it. Okay? Anybody been able to multiply two of these numbers yet? Okay. 45. I'm not sure about that one. Okay. I'll guess minus one. And were they minus 1?
I'm fine with that one, then.
Oh, there was... you had plus 1? They were both plus 1s? 5 and 9, right? Okay. So I lost. Okay, somebody in Redmond, multiply two of the numbers and try it. Anybody there? Come on, I want to get you involved. All I'm asking you to do is multiply two of one-digit numbers. Somebody there in Redmond can probably do that.
Excel there?
Somebody. Okay.
77.
77. Okay, I'm going to guess. Okay, I'm going to guess 77 is a minus 1. Am I right?
Yes.
Yes. Yeah, it's 7 times 11. I'll skip the step. You don't have to tell it to me. Okay. Are you going to try to call me on this, or you want to try to play again? 225. Okay, I'm going to guess that's plus ones.
Go either way.
Okay, you're getting ahead of me. That's why I don't want to play this game too long, because, yeah, there's some issues here. In particular, let's try it the other way. I'll pick a number. I'll pick the number you pick, 45. I like 45, okay? So anybody want to guess? Well, people are too quiet in Redmond. Somebody here guess, plus whether it's plus one or minus one. People are too quick. So 45, the number here that was guessed. Well, this is 5 times 9,
or
3 times 15. So Alice can cheat by picking 45. You play the game, and Alice picks 45, Bob says plus 1, Bob loses. Bob says minus 1, Bob loses. We went to a lot of trouble to put together this game, and it's not working very well. So what's the problem here?
You need to use large values. Is that why?
I don't think large values are the problem. You still might be able to break
prime
this one.
Prime.
Okay, I'm hearing primes. Was there another?
Well, is it because type minus 1 is the product of a type plus 1 and a type minus 1?
It can be that you can decompose things more than just one way. So you might get a minus 1 that actually is a minus 1 and a plus 1, or there may be multiple decompositions. So the way we're going to fix that is to make a small change here. Instead of saying pick two large integers, we're going to say pick two large primes. Okay. Now I know, you know, many of you are saying, right already. You're way ahead on this. Good. Well, I promise, we'll pick things up a little bit. If you pick primes, this works. If you presented it the way I first presented it, then even though Bob can't cheat, Alice can. So one of the lessons of that is don't ever trust a cryptographer. But you probably know that one already. You certainly will by the end of the quarter of now. So this does work perfectly well with prime numbers. If the two numbers are primes, then Alice has no choice in how to break up a product of two primes. It can only be broken up back into those two primes, and she can't change those primes. And then this actually does work. Now, one thing that you might ask, and I will, once I get that pattern to work, we'll mention this briefly, is a question comes up of, how does Alice know that she's picked primes? How does Bob know that the numbers Alice gave him were primes? Well, it turns out that even very large numbers, it's possible to check whether or not they're primes. And it's possible to do this efficiently. And I'm going to mention a mathematical result. We're not going to talk about it in any detail now. But it shows sort of some of the kinds of things that happen a lot on the public key side of cryptography. So there's a basic mathematical result in group theory that says if you have a prime number and you pick some integer, some positive integer smaller than that number, so the prime number, the number you start with is p, it's prime, you pick some a smaller than p, and if you do this computation, a to the p minus 1 mod p, everybody here knows what mod is? It's going to be important, we'll talk about it. Just remainder when divided by. If you're not comfortable with the word mod, substitute remainder when divided by. So raise a to the power p minus 1, divide it by p, the remainder will always be 1 if p is a prime. Yes?
Is that true for any a in that range?
That is true for any a in that range.
You have to show it's true for all a's in that range?
You don't have to show that, but even if you did show that, well, I guess that would be enough for this. But there is a key, you're at a key observation here, in that this doesn't actually allow you to prove that a number is prime. It does allow you to prove that a number is not prime. If this formula
fails,
you know that p is not prime. Right? The premise cannot be true because the conclusion is false. So this is a way you find a single a that falsifies this formula, and you know your p, it's p, it looks like it's prime because it's called p, but it's not a prime. Okay? So it's very easy to prove that a number is composite, not prime, composite. However, proving that a number is prime is actually much harder, although in practice it's not so bad because of the second fact here, that this formula, it very rarely is true when p is composite when P is not prime. So if I take P and I take several smaller random numbers and I do this computation and all the time it comes out to 1, then I'm going to be pretty sure that P is prime. And we're going to use things like that quite a bit. And that'll be good enough for here. Okay, is there a question?
Yeah, what's the common way of coming up with primes algorithmically?
The most common way is basically pick a big number, see if it's prime. If it's not, pick another one.
Okay.
Now, there are ways of being a little bit more efficient, and we'll talk a little bit about it. But there's something called the sieve of Eratosthenes, which is a way of pairing out a lot of the things that you know are not prime so that you're concentrating on... You get rid of the things with small factors very quickly so that you're concentrating on only things that have a good chance. You know, you don't want to just pick a number that's even. And try this. Well, if it ends in 5, don't even bother with this. So, you know, that's some pairing that you can do. And you can get rid of multiples of 3 and multiples of all small primes very quickly and easily and be left with a few candidates that you then try this more elaborate procedure on. And we'll talk about this more.
Well, in the protocol that you gave us, though, Alice has all the time in the world to find a composite P that does satisfy this.
She's
in an excellent position to cheat and it would be very hard to detect.
Yes and no. Yes, that's a good point. However, it depends on how you quantify things. And it's not the case that there is a composite. In fact, there are no composites for which this is always true. There are some composites for which this formula does hold most of the time, but barely most of the time. There are some very special, very rare numbers for which this holds most of the time. But still, if it holds 60% of the time, if Bob picks a few A's, he's almost sure to say, wait a minute, I just found an exception. We can talk about it a little bit. There are things called pseudoprimes and Carmichael numbers and other things that actually have this come out to 1 a non-trivial fraction of the time, but it's still way, way short of all the time. Or even most of the time. So this is still an effective test. But you're right. If you're going to be a devious Alice and you want to tilt the odds in your favor, you might try that. But your chance of winning the coin flip fair is probably a lot better than your chance of doing this and getting away with it. So, but it's a valid point. Okay. Let me see. I know we want to take a break soon. So I just want to get through sort of how these two answers are reconciled, and then we will, I've got some quick slides here, and then we'll take a break. So I gave you two answers, right? This can be done, it can't be done. And we talked a little bit about what the issues are. But first of all, getting at what you were mentioning here, the impossibility proof that I gave had an implicit assumption that that the two parties can compute indefinitely. That they could just, figure out this path I win, this path you win. And, that's all there is to it. Well, maybe that's true that if you go down this path, you'll win, but it might be like chess. It might be that it's just so complicated, there are so many possibilities. And just think about what the tree would look like for the game that I just described. It's a very small, it's a very shallow tree. It's a very wide tree. And computing on that tree is actually very hard. So it assumes unlimited computational ability. You don't have that in practice. In this case, if Bob was guessing, he didn't have time. But it's also the case that this protocol is not perfect 50-50. And that did seem to be one of the things we were asking about. Bob does have a small advantage. Bob could get the number from Alice and say, well, I'm going to spend 2 minutes trying to factor it. Bob's chance of factoring it is pretty small, but he might guess, well, maybe Alice picked this prime. Let me see if this is one of the factors. Nope, okay, let me try this one. He can try for a little while. His odds of winning go from 50-50 to 50.00001 or something to 49 point lots of nines, but still, it's not perfect 50-50. Bob can spend a little bit of time trying to defeat this. Okay. Now, this simple thing that we did has a bunch of applications. I'm not going to get into the big stuff before the break, but you could do this for remote card playing. Internet gambling. How do you know that the poker hand that you got really is a random shuffle of the cards? Right? Do you know that? I would like to know that. I would like to know that the gaming is fair. So all kinds of internet gambling, fair agreement protocols, deciding where to have something, and the mechanism that we used for this was effectively bit commitment. What happened was Alice committed to a value that she could not later change. And then that commitment was made to Bob. Alice could open it, but she couldn't change it. Okay? And that commitment can be used for lots of other applications, sealed bidding, undisclosed contracts, authenticated predictions of various kinds, things like, I'm guessing the stock market will be at such and such in a year, but I'll influence the market if I say it, so I want to seal it up in some way. Well, that's the sort of thing you can do with this. But also, we're doing this, taking this a little bit further. What we actually did was constructed a one-way function. Okay? And what we've done is implemented bit commitment by using a one-way function. And one-way functions have lots of applications, more mainstream applications. Authentication, data integrity, strong randomness, etc. And let's see, we've got, I want to talk about one-way functions. Well, is it okay if I take 5 more minutes before the break to talk about one-way functions and then we'll have a break? Will anybody object strongly? Nobody in Redmond is saying anything, so... Okay. This is your chance to actually say something, like no. Okay. So let me take 5 minutes here just to give a little bit of a brief sense of what one-way functions are, what's going on, because we're going to be using these things a lot. So, there we go. There are 2 basic classes of one-way functions. First, you've got a sense of what a one-way function is. I've got my slides in funny order. I'll define it in a second. But there are 2 basic kinds of one-way functions. We just saw one. Multiplying numbers together is a one-way function, effectively. It's easy to do it. It's very hard to factor it undo it. So there are mathematical one-way functions like multiplication and like modular exponentiation. Y to the x mod n is a one-way function that we're going to be talking about a lot. And we're going to be talking about a good deal right after the break. Then there is a class that is just ugly. Throw stuff together. Take all the bits and scramble them, XOR them with themselves, take the last bit here, flip it, and put it in there, whatnot. There are a lot of one-way functions that look like that. At least things that we believe are one-way functions. These are all things that we believe are one-way functions. Now, this is actually getting at the principal dichotomy within cryptography, and it sort of goes all the way up through all of computer science. Right? This department is CSE, Computer Science and Engineering. Is computer study a science or an engineering discipline? Well, there are some parts that are definitely a science. You study algorithms, you study theory of computation, theorems, proofs, lots of theory and structure. This is science. Programming languages, lots of other areas, are definitely engineering disciplines. This works. Here's a heuristic, here's an approach, this works well, this doesn't work well. And the two are kind of combined together. Well, we got that schism right through cryptography. Public key cryptography, asymmetric cryptography, which we'll be talking about for probably a minority of this class, but an important part of cryptography, is very much a theoretical science. Traditional symmetric key cryptography, and I'll talk a lot more about what that is, and this will probably be the majority, is definitely an engineering discipline. This heuristic seems to work. Don't do that because bad things seem to happen. Here's some bad things that happen. Do it this way, do it that way. There's very little theory. So it's right here, and we see that right here in classes of one-way functions. We've got the sort of the scientifically based, and we've got the engineering based down here. Now, saying ugly is not, I feel I'm being a little unfair in that. They're not bad. They're just There's no theory behind them.
Having seen the DES algorithm, I wouldn't argue.
Okay, good. Yeah, DES is a good case. So, all these bits, flip, whatever. Okay. So, yeah, I guess that's as far as I want to go before the break. I'll talk about this some afterwards. Why don't we stop now and resume in 10 minutes, which by my watch will be 43 past. It's now 33 past. All right, so I was an 11-minute break. Aha, won't let that happen again. So, is everybody ready? Any questions over part one?
I think I have the number.
Let's get the phone number first.
425. 707.
707.
3090.
3090. Okay, thank you very much. Now go sit down. Okay, question?
So, if at each step the number of decisions was not a discrete or finite number, but was infinite, would that change?
I don't see how you can have a finite protocol where there are actually an infinite number of choices at a step. Effectively, the number of choices are bounded by, you have to represent the choices somehow. It's going to take a certain number of bits.
A voltage on a dial or something.
Oh, well, okay. So we're going to get into continuous mathematics rather than discrete mathematics. I don't know how to do that on a computer. Maybe if we have some perfect physical analogy and we have some rheostat that we're turning. Maybe. I don't know. I haven't thought about this. It's an interesting possibility. But digitally, it's finite. Really no way around that. Is there another question?
Well, I was going to ask, back to my random question. If the path you chose was based on a random number generated at the time, suddenly you no longer have the ability to control your fate, you know, essentially. You don't know.
Right, but you usually want the ability to control your fate. If I can look and say, well, this path I'm going to win and that path I'm going to lose, I can either choose the path I'm going to win or maybe I'll use randomness to let it decide. If I've got a winning path, I want to take it.
Sure.
Yeah.
There are plenty of games we play where we don't have that.
Right. Yeah. That's to make the games fun. That's not to make it so that you can win. Yeah, if you had a source of randomness that was mutually trusted. If you had a coin that you could flip together, a die that you could roll, some mutually trusted source of randomness, then the problem is trivial. But if you're in separate places and there's nothing but you and your partner in these two places, no other source, then you know, that proof really does apply, but it's limited. It's limited mostly by limited computational ability. That's what allows us to get a practical protocol to do this.
So being paranoid, I call that number we thought was that.
Yeah.
I didn't get.
Okay, so that number doesn't seem to be 707.
No, 7390.
Okay, so hey, people in Redmond, that number doesn't seem to work. But well, it's possible that the dialer is dead. I'll check on it tomorrow. That's the building my office is in, so it's easy enough for me to check on it. Okay. Barring no further questions.
Josh.
Oh yeah. Questions?
There's one question over there.
Yeah.
Just actually for future reference, Bruce Schneier got his NV5 constants right on the CD.
On the CD, okay.
Yeah. So if you spend an extra $40, you can get everything correct.
Oh, good. Well, I guess the Chinese team trusted the book, so if people didn't hear, apparently...
They probably couldn't get the CD at the time.
Yeah, that's true. It might have been export controls.
But yet in China.
But apparently the CD of Bruce's book has the contents of MD5 correct. Point of fact. I didn't know that. Thank you. That's interesting. I thought it was supposed to be a perfect match, but, you know... You can't, that's the problem with the book. You can't depend on things that are supposed to be the same being the same. So you can get yourself in trouble. Okay, so I mentioned one one-way function a little bit earlier, just multiplication. I'm mentioning another one here, modular exponentiation. Just to be clear again, The mod is remainder when divided by. So this is sort of a pretty simple looking equation. Take y, raise to the x power, take the remainder when divided by n, that's your answer. Okay? This is, in many ways, a fundamental equation of cryptography. At least of the public key, the scientific side. And that we'll be talking about mostly tonight. Most of the class will be talking about the symmetric aspects, the engineering side, but this is more fun, right? Well, we'll see. It's more fun for me. So I'm talking tonight, this is what I get to talk about. And it's worth spending some time exploring this equation, because it really is an equation that has lots of applications, lots of different uses. So let me just take a look at a few ways of looking at this, what unknowns can be solved for, what can't be, how things work. So suppose that you've got y, x, and n, and you want to solve for z, you want to compute z, you want to do modular exponentiation. Is this possible? And the answer is, yeah, it's easy to do, it's efficient. Even if the numbers are huge, it's efficiently doable. And we'll spend some time talking about how to do it in just a few minutes. It's not as obvious as you might think, but yes, this is doable. But I'm just sort of going through the overview now. When x is the unknown in this equation, then this is known as the discrete logarithm problem. Okay? If we didn't have a mod n here, this would just be x is the logarithm of z base y. And computing logarithms is easy. But we're not in that case. Let me see if I can remember how to do it. Erase. There. We're in the mod n case, and it's no longer just an ordinary logarithm. And it's very hard to solve. At least, we believe it to be very hard to solve. No one knows a good way to solve this. And the reason for the difference is that if you're in the continuous case, the case without mod n, how do you solve this? Well, it's successive approximation. Right? You find an x that looks sort of good, and you say, oh, well, you compute things out. It's a little too big. It's a little too small. You use one of the standard iteration formulas to narrow down exactly where you're going, and you get, with very small error, a very accurate value for x very quickly. When you're doing things discretely, mod n, the mod function really throws away all the high-order stuff and keeps just the low stuff. The low bits. This is just the remainder. We don't care about the quotient. Most of the time you're doing division, you care about the quotient. The remainder is just a little leftover stuff. Well, we're throwing away the quotient and keeping just this little leftover stuff. And when you do something like y to the x, that little leftover stuff is completely chaotic. It just bounces all over the place. You don't have this nice, smooth, continuously growing function. You increase x by a little bit. You increase y to the x by a little bit. You change y to the x mod n in some completely random way. So there's no notion of solving this by some sort of successive approximation, and nobody knows any good alternative for this. Nobody knows a good way of solving this equation. Okay? And this is a very important use of this equation, and we'll talk about this in a few minutes also. Okay? How about when y is the unknown here? Well, this is known as discrete root finding. Okay? Again, question?
Real quick, just the level of chaoticness, doesn't that kind of depend on the size of n, too?
It will depend on the size of n. If n is not very big, then yes, this is manageable. If n is small, you can solve these equations. And yes, you're right. I should have made that clear. I'll get to that. These are difficult to solve for large integers, but if n is 2, it's not hard to solve. If n is 100, or even 1,000,000, it's not hard to solve. Basically, there are only 1,000,000 possibilities mod n. You should try them all, probably. But if n is very big, we don't know any good way of solving it. And the same thing is true here. If n is small, then root finding is doable. Certainly in the continuous case, root finding is doable. Take a cube root. If x is 3, then what we're saying is we're looking for the cube root of z. Taking the cube root, we know how to do. Taking the cube root mod n, we have no idea how to do. With an exception. It's hard for large integers unless we know the factorization of n. It turns out, and we will talk about this also, if you know the factorization of n, you can do discrete root finding. And it's not completely obvious. You shouldn't be thinking, gee, I don't see how to do it. You must be missing something. And it'll take a little bit of explanation. But it's computationally feasible. And that turns out to be critically important. This is the basis of the RSA cryptosystem. The previous discrete log problem is the basis of the Diffie-Hellman key exchange algorithm. These are sort of the two pillars of public key cryptography. Okay. Lastly, for completeness, I'll ask the question about what if n is unknown? And this is actually a problem I've sort of scribbled at for 10, 15 minutes sometimes. It looks kind of interesting. I don't know any solutions. I'm not sure what to do with it. But I don't think anybody's really worked very much on this problem. And I will try to take opportunities like this to mention, assuming we do a final project, maybe exploring this case would be a good final project. Just trying to understand what you could do in this case. Okay. So, that said, let's go back to the first case. How do you actually do the computation y to the x mod n? How do you implement it so that it works very quickly on large numbers? Now, it's doable, but if you try it the obvious ways, it may not be quite so obvious. It might not be so easy. So, let's take a look. One thing you could do is compute y to the x power and then take the result mod n. And that works if y is 3 and x is 5 and n is 12 or something like that. But for cryptography, we usually use things like 1,000-bit numbers, large enough so that the properties we want of factoring being difficult, root finding being difficult, discrete log being difficult really do hold. And 1,000-bit numbers, you get into a problem. Just compute 1,000-bit number to 1,000-bit power. Right? See, if you do this, compute this 1,000-bit number to 1,000-bit power, the result is going to have about a little over 2 to the 1,000 bits. Now, just for reference, I'll point out there are about 2 to the 250 particles in the universe. So storing this number that has 2 to the 1,000 bits is a bit of a problem, because even if every particle stored a bit, you wouldn't have enough particles. It wouldn't be anywhere close. So writing down this number is kind of problematic. You can't just build the number and then reduce it. Okay, so we have to look for another way. Now,
find more universes.
Yeah, you have to find a lot of universes, and not just a couple more isn't going to do it. Right? You need 10 to the 750 universes, 2 to the 750 universes there to do it. Roughly. I'm allowed to be extemporaneous here. One thing you could do is not wait till the end to reduce things mod n. One nice thing about this mod function is you can do it at intermediate steps and things will work well. You don't have to do y to the x, after all, is y times y times y times y times y. I want to say x times, but you're actually doing x minus 1 multiplications, right? Y squared is one multiplication, not two. So you're off by one there. But you're doing a whole bunch of multiplications. You could, each time you do a multiplication, just reduce it mod n so that the result goes up to twice the size of n, and then you reduce it back down to something smaller than n. It gets twice as big and smaller each time. Never get too big. Number of particles in the universe is not a problem anymore. Okay? We're fine. However, still a lot of multiplications. You're doing 2 to the 1,000 multiplications. Right? Now, 32-bit machine, standard, you're doing these multiplications, you're going to have a bit of a problem. You're going to have to do something like 2 to the 900 multiplications, 32-bit multiplications per second to make this work before the sun burns out. And
it's a little bit of overclocking.
Yeah. Right. Now, I will say that if Moore's law continues for another 1,000 years, this should be possible. But
the ship would be as hot as the sun then.
Yes, there would be other problems with this. And we don't want to use all the world's computing resources 1,000 years hence to do this one calculation. So we'd better be able to do better, or why am I standing here talking about this? So let me try to give you a better way. And what I'll do first is talk about how to multiply. Right? Exponentiation is really just repeated multiplication. Multiplication is really just repeated addition. And in its simplest form, multiplication is just repeated doubling. And I'll explain what I mean by this. So if you're going to compute x times y, one good way to do this, and essentially what you would do on a machine in hardware, is write down x in binary, and you just have y, 2 times y, 4 times y, 8 times y. I shouldn't be doing this. I should be doing this. 4 times y, 8 times y, 16 times y. Keep on doing that. And that's just adding a zero. This is shifting. This is no problem. And what you do is add up whichever of these values are necessary to get your product according to the representation of x. So, rather than trying to understand those bizarre phrases that I just strung together, I'll give you an example. Suppose you want to compute 26y. Well, 26 in binary, no 1s, 1, 2, no 4s, 1, 8, and 1, 16 here. Right? So, all I need to do is double this to get that, double again. There are 4 doublings. And then 2 additions down here. 1 addition, 2 addition. Okay? Instead of full addition, which would be 25 additions to get 26 y's, I'm just doing 4 doublings, each of which is an easy addition, adding something to itself, and 2 more additions down down here.
Is there an algorithmic way you came up with the 2, 8, and 16 there?
I wrote x in binary. X in binary, 26 in binary, would look like 1, 1, 0. Yeah. Erase. Let's see if that works. 26 is 1, 1, 0, 1, 0. And that is saying, you know, don't take the first one. Now I have to turn this backwards. But 0 says don't take the first one. 1 says take the next one, etc.
Okay. Thanks.
So we can do this to multiply. Okay, well, we already know how to multiply. But we can do this for that. Now let's do this for exponentiation. Well, exponentiation can be done by repeated squaring. In exactly the same way. To compute y and x, we compute successive squares of y, and then multiply together those values as indicated by the binary representation of the exponent x. So, the same example. If we want y to the 26th power, then we've done 1 squaring, 2 squarings, 3 squarings, 4 squarings, and then we have to multiply together just the orangish ones here, do this multiplication and that multiplication, and instead of 25 multiplications to get y to the 26th, we did 4 squarings, 4 easy multiplications, and although it's not obvious at this point that those are any easier, they're certainly just multiplications, and then 2 more multiplications down here, so let's just say 6 multiplications. It's a lot better than 25. Okay? And this gets a lot better as the numbers get much larger. So this is crucial if you're going to implement anything like this. So you can now do a 1,000-bit modular exponentiation using about 1,500 1,000-bit modular multiplications. And multiplying 2,000-bit numbers doesn't take that long. It actually winds up being on the order of 1,032-bit multiplies. Okay? But of these 1,500 multiplications that you're doing, let's just break it down a little bit, you're doing 1,000 squarings here. Right? You're just going y squared, y squared, all the way up to the highest power that you might consider, and then you're multiplying together the ones from here that you need select according to the binary representation of x. And on average, you would expect x to be about half ones. So about half of these things over here are getting multiplied together. So you're doing about 500 ordinary multiplications. So about 1,500 total multiplications to make this work. Okay. Now, I'll mention one shortcut that you can take that you can speed that can speed things up a bit. Let me do this, and I'll go back. It's called the sliding window method, just the window method. I won't get into the sliding part, but essentially, what you can do is some pre-computation. For instance, suppose I compute y squared, y cubed, y to the 15th. I've changed colors. I'm clever. So I've got all these things computed. If you want to multiply by y to the 13th, the way we were doing it before was, okay, we need the y, we need the y to the 4th, we need the y to the 8th, and somewhere in this large multiplication, this large set of multiplications, you need to multiply by y to the 13th, you're doing three multiplications here. Well, if you've got this, it's just one multiplication. So you're saving a large fraction of the multiplications, something on the order of half of the multiplications, by just building a small table. And instead of going one square at a time and saying, square, do I include this, yes or no? Square, do I include this, yes or no? You square, 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 four squares, and then you include one of 16 possibilities. And I won't go into that in any more detail. If you're interested in that, it's something we can talk about, or maybe you could even research this further as something to present in some way. Although I'm not sure, there's enough detail if you talk about all the variants of this, the regular window, sliding window, how to make all these things work, to maybe make a project.
John,
okay. Yes.
Question real quick.
Yeah.
The assumption that y would be fixed for a long time, and you might do this repeatedly with different values of x?
That is the assumption. Well, the assumption here is that y is fixed. In practice, just for 1,000-bit computation, y and x are both fixed. But for the duration of that computation, you're still, by building a small table, saving a lot of the multiplications along the way. So just even for one particular y and x, you do actually save a lot by building a small table and just using that table for that computation and then throwing it away. Now, if you have the same y repeatedly, yeah, you can keep it around, but that's an unlikely situation in practice. Okay, did I answer it?
Yes.
Okay, good. So, I'm going to talk a little about some of the operations, the typical large integer operations, addition, subtraction, multiplication, division, exponentiation, and just try to get an understanding of how to do all of these things better, or how we would do them in practice, because you need to know to be able to see what's going to work and what's not going to work, and make this reasonably efficient. So, how do you add together large integers? So the first thing I'm doing is showing you, these are integers that are bigger than the word size on the machine you're likely to be using. So what I've done is taken an integer and broken it up into four words here. So if you're using a 32-bit machine, this would be how you do 128-bit additions, perhaps. In practice, if you've got a 1,000-bit number in a 32-bit machine, you've got a full 1024-bit number would be 32 blocks. I guess 1,000. I guess you still go on to the 32nd block with 1,000 bits. So anyway, for ease of representation, I'm showing you four blocks. And to add two numbers of this form, here's another four-block number. All you do is exactly what you were taught to do in school. It's just base 2 to the 32 instead of base 10. Right? You add these two, you get a carry, you add the carry to these two, you carry, you add here, you get a carry, and you keep on going. Okay?
Can you change your pin color? It's a little hard to see.
Is the green worse? I was thinking the red was a little too harsh, but okay, I'll go back to red. Actually, let me try that. How's the yellow? Is that good?
Yeah.
Oh, yellow's nice. Right. Okay. Okay. So you add the last one, the last block, you add the next blocks, you add here, you add here, and did I jump past it? I jumped down too far, sorry. You keep on adding. And in general, it's a pretty easy thing to do. You just go right down the two numbers. If you have two integers, there are each n blocks, then you're doing n small additions. Add the last block, add this block, add this block, and just keep the carry in. No problem. And subtracting large integers is similar. You just zip right down the blocks, effectively. Not a problem. Okay. Now, multiplication. How do you do this? Is this going to be doable in four multiplications? Just like we were able to do four additions here. Well, not so well. Remember, again, your school algorithm, you have to multiply this thing here by everything up here. So there are four multiplications just to get this first row, and there might be a little carry over there. That's why I've got that. Then you've got four more multiplications, and four more there, and four more there. 16 total. Okay? Then, of course, you have to add up everything, so you've got some additions in there. The additions are relatively cheap. But there are a lot of small 32-bit multiplications to get this one large one. And that's why I said if you're doing a 1024-bit multiplication on a 32-bit machine, you're doing about 1,000 multiplies. Actually, you've got 32 blocks. 32 times 32 is 1024. That's why you've got roughly 1024 little multiplies. That's still 1,000 multiplies in a machine that runs 4 gigahertz. It's not that bad. You can do about a million times a second. But if you're doing a lot of these, it adds up pretty quickly. Okay. So from here, we can see we've got n squared time instead of n time to multiply two large integers. Now, I'm going to mention squaring because we singled this out as something special. Doubling was certainly easier when we were doing multiplications by repeated doubling. Well, we're doing our exponentiation by repeated squaring. Is squaring any easier? Well, let me show you something. When you square, you're still multiplying each pair together, but here we're multiplying this pair, and later on, we're going to be multiplying this pair. Well, if you're squaring things, these two are equal. And let's see if I can get rid of that. These two are equal. And these two are equal. And these two are equal. So this multiplication and the previous multiplication are multiplying equal pairs of things together. So those two multiplications, which are going to be placed in different places in the result, are going to be the same multiplication. So if you're clever about this and you do a little bit of extra bookkeeping, you can save almost half the multiplications by just saying, wait a minute, I've already done this one. I can just stick this value right there where it's going to need to be, where it's collected in an appropriate way. So squaring is about half the cost of an ordinary multiplication, at least done in this way. And that's why when I said 1,000 squarings, 500 ordinary multiplications, that was important because the squarings take only half the time of or each squaring takes only half the time. So you're getting rid of a third of the overall time by doing the squarings a little bit more intelligently. Okay. So yeah, careful bookkeeping can save half the time. So this is what I've already said. Okay. In fact, it's exactly what I already said. About two thirds of the multiplications and an exponentiation of squarings. So you save about a third of the time. Okay, Another trick I'm going to mention, just briefly, it's a cute little trick, and it gets into when things get large, is called Carrot-Suba multiplication. And it's easier to talk about with polynomials. So I'm going to start this out with polynomials. So let's have the polynomial. These are just binomials, right? Ax plus b, cx plus d. You multiply them out like you learned to do in ninth grade algebra. You get that. Okay? How many multiplications would it take to do this? Well, 4, right? You multiplied a times c, you multiplied a times d, you multiplied b times c, you multiplied b times d, and you did one addition. You did an addition right there. These aren't really additions when you've got the polynomial there. That's what I'm going for. Those are just formal additions. That's not actually a computation of any kind. That's just saying 3x plus 5. You don't actually add 3x and 5. Okay? So there are 4 multiplications and an addition. Oh, and actually, I've got... See, this is the advantage of being able to mark. I was able to show all that to you without going through a bunch of slides to show you the same thing. One addition. There's the addition. Okay. So that's the total. Okay. Now, Carrot-Suba... Oh, so I'm a little ahead of myself. Let me go back one slide. Carrot-Suba says... I'm going to do something strange. I'm going to drop the x's out of these polynomials. And I'm just going to add a and b, adding the coefficients. This is very strange. Ax plus b, I add 3x plus 5 is 8 somehow. But I'm just going to add the x coefficient to the constant coefficient here and here. And you get a result. When you multiply that out, that's what you get. Okay, why do we care? Well, if we take that product and subtract off A times C and B times D, you get AD plus BC, which is exactly the middle term up here. Now, how many multiplications did it take me to get that? Well, I've got a bunch of slides that count this. You want to go through the slides? Here we go. Oh, 3 multiplications, 2 additions. Here. You've got this multiplication here, the big one. It's not really big, it just looks big on paper. And then you've got this multiplication here, this multiplication here. And you did 2 additions. The additions are this and that, that, and then 2 subtractions, that and that. And 3 multiplications, 2 additions, 2 subtractions, you managed to get all the values you needed. The values you needed were AC, AD plus BC, and BD to do that. Now, normally you might think, you know, this is not a very good trade-off. I had one fewer multiplication, and I had an extra addition and 2 new subtractions. It looks like a lot of extra work. Right? And certainly it's a lot messier, a lot more bookkeeping, a lot harder to think about. Well, yes, if you're thinking of multiplications and additions as roughly equal cost. But when you're doing very large integers, those multiplications are way more expensive than the additions and subtractions. So you can save about a quarter of the multiplications by just one step of this in exchange for a couple of additions and subtractions. It's a trade-off that's well worth it. And you can do this recursively. So you effectively break a big number into the high half and the low half, and you apply Carrot-Suba multiplication, but now you can take each of these halves and do Carrot-Suba on each of those halves, and save a substantial fraction, save close to a third of the multiplications overall. Okay. So, this thing can be done, what I showed you was for polynomials. This can be done on integers as well as polynomials. But it's not as nice on integers because you get carries and you have to do bookkeeping because now you take 2 32-bit integers and you add them, now there might be an overflow and then you've got an extra bit to deal with. And it gets a little bit messy. But the larger the integers, the more the benefit. There's an asymptotic benefit of doing this. Okay. So here it's just saying do the same thing. I've already pointed this out except that what we've got is instead of x here, we've got 2 to the k. 2 to the k is just whatever it takes to get the first half separated from the lower half, the high bits and the low bits. And then everything works out in pretty much the same way, 2 to the 2k here instead of x squared, and you do everything and it comes out to be about the same. Okay. Another trick I'll mention is Chinese remaindering. Chinese remaindering is important if you know the factorization of your modulus. And there are many cases where you do know the factorization of your modulus. If you do, it's a tremendous benefit. If I know a value, what a value is mod p, and what a value is mod q, I can put them together, and I won't bother going into how now, although you may get a chance to do that yourselves. Here's sort of the basics of it. You can put things together and figure out what x is mod pq, mod the product. So I can take the small value, combine them to get a large value. Why do we care? Why would this work? Well, exponentiation is an expensive operation. It is more expensive than multiplication. It's cubic rather than quadratic. If I can cut things in half, I'm saving a lot. It's an eighth the time to do something half the size. Well, if I do two things one-eighth the size, or two things half the size, takes one-eighth the time, one-eighth the time, total one-quarter of the time, put them together, it's a lot easier to break things apart and do the small things and then put them together. So this is a tremendous benefit, and pretty much what I just said. If you're going to do a computation modulo PQ, you can do it mod P, you can do it mod Q, and then use Chinese remaindering to put them together. This is, Chinese remaindering is said by some to be the world's oldest algorithm. It's, you know, something you can take advantage of. We get the value mod N and, you know, save ourselves some effort. And how much effort is what I just said, that, you know, since it's cubic time, you can save about a factor of 4. Okay. I'll mention one other thing and then move on, because I, you know, the implementation can get tedious, let's say. So multiplying A times B mod N, you would think, well, you multiply A times B, now you divide. Well, how do you divide? Think about how you were taught to divide in school versus how you were taught to multiply, add, subtract. Addition, you do this, you learn your multiplication table, you do this, carry this, multiplication, this. Division. Well, to divide, you look at the dividend, and you look at the divisor, and you guess. I have not seen a guess instruction in the Intel instruction set. Guess is not a very easy operation for a computer. Division of large integers is really, really ugly. Slow, cumbersome, and very difficult. In fact, if I had animated slides, you'd be seeing occasionally things like that pop up every now and then. That. But I have to do that by hand, so you don't get the full effect. But it's really a painful thing to do. And it's much, much slower than multiplying in most cases. There really is some sort of approximation. You guess, you correct. There are some theorems that enable you to do it a little bit better. But it's, you know, the hardest thing to do. If you were in a first course in programming, and I've done this when I taught first courses in programming, it can give you an assignment. Early on, you've done very little programming, to do a large integer calculator. And doing the additions, the subtractions, the multiplications, yeah, no problem. First course in programming can do that. The division is extra credit. Nobody gets the division. No, it's way too hard. And you can try. You can get it. You know, I won't say nobody. Some people have occasionally. But in the first course in programming, it's so much harder than the rest. And it's much, much slower than the rest. So that's going to be taking most of our time, unless we can find a way around it. So, let's see. Get rid of this. get rid of all these nice moving slides and move on to something called the Montgomery method. Again, something I don't want to spend a lot of time on, but the Montgomery method effectively performs a domain transformation into a domain where division is easy, or at least no harder than multiplication. And you do everything in that domain, and then if you need to come back. Sometimes you can get away with just staying there the whole time. So what you would do with a modular exponentiation, typically, is you transform everything into this Montgomery domain. And you do all your computations there, and at the end you come back. And even if the transformations are a little bit painful, it's so much of a benefit to not have to do the hard work. So let me just give you the mathematics. There's no way you're going to understand this in the 60 seconds that's going to be devoted to it. But basically, here is everything that you need to know about Montgomery multiplication here. You want to multiply A and B mod M. Okay? A times B mod M is what you care about. And these are all N block integers. Just base X. X is the block size, 2 to the 32, say. You compute this value R, which is which is 1 followed by 0, the number of blocks. So if you've got 32 bit blocks, this is 2 to the 1024. And the only thing you require is that there's no common factor between the modulus and this value. The Montgomery product is this funny special product. The Montgomery product of A and B is A times B times R inverse, mod M. Now this seems like, wow, why would I do that? That is a real pain to compute. Well, it turns out if you compute once and for all at the beginning of the computation, M prime, which is just this value here, negative M inverse mod R. You can compute this value, and it turns out that this gives you the Montgomery product, A times B times R inverse. A times B plus S times M, so these are multiplications and addition, divided by R. Now why, and I'm still doing dividing, yeah, but I'm dividing by 2 to the 1024. Dividing by something like that is just truncating. I can divide by that. Let's just take you've got 1024-bit integers, you've got a 2048-bit product now, and dividing by R is just drop the low-order half. That's easy. Okay? So how do you actually make use of this? Well, it's because of what I just said, because of that formula, the Montgomery product can be computed in about the time of two ordinary multiplications. And that's way faster than a normal division. The Montgomery transform that I mentioned is just going from A to A times R mod M. Now, if I take the product of A times R, that's A in Montgomery land is A times R, and B times R, which is B in Montgomery land. Remember, the product is multiply these two things together and then take out a factor of R. I've got A times B times R, which is just AB in Montgomery land. So I just multiply by R at the start to do the transformation, and everything is in this Montgomery land view. And then I do these much simpler multiplications, or simpler divisions effectively, by just doing multiplications. I've just got this extra factor of R that I'm carrying along everywhere. And at the very end of the computation, I divide out that R. I do one division instead of dividing all the time. And things become way, way, way less painful. Okay? Good. So, might be a good time to take break two before going to some of the more cryptographic aspects of this equation, some one-way functions and trapdoors and some of the basics. So why don't we take a 10-minute break now, and we will resume again at 38 past, 10 minutes from now. Okay? My super accurate watch, which really does get its time radio set from Joan Boulder, Colorado, says it's 38 past. Okay. Water isn't as easy as the time. So, any questions on what we just talked about? Okay. We've been in sort of geeky implementation land for the past while, right? There's some people who really like that stuff. I think for a lot of people, it's important to know about. If you're ever going to build anything like this, there's a huge difference between just building it in the straightforward way and building it with care. And there's a lot of expertise. In fact, Peter Montgomery, the inventor of the Montgomery method, is really better than anybody else at getting every last cycle out of these implementations. And these things really do take an extraordinary amount of time. If you've got a server which is sitting around all day doing decryptions, then making it run 10% faster means that my server farm, which is, if I'm Amazon, I've got this, I can use 10% fewer machines. This becomes a big deal. Okay.
On the OpenSSL BigNum library, how efficient is it?
I don't know. Brian, do you know how that compares? I thought there were some issues.
I think so. I haven't actually looked at current numbers. But Apache's still built.
Right. Yeah. There were some issues with some timing attacks on OpenSSL.
If we're just talking performance, I think the performance is pretty good.
Just of the BigNum library.
I know that there are a few proprietary company versions of certain encryption algorithms out there that we evaluated it in a project I'm working on at Boeing, and they all claim to blow OpenSSL out of the water. They said it was just really slow. So
it wouldn't surprise me. It takes a lot of work to shave off that improvement in performance, and most people, especially in an open implementation like that, unless you're incentivized to do it, it's tedious work. Most people don't enjoy it. This works. It's good enough. Why would I bother? So, you've got to get somebody who's really good at it and willing to make this their full-time job for 3 years to really make this better. And I don't know if OpenSSL is going to do that. We will mention later some of the attack possibilities, and OpenSSL did have some issue with timing attacks. And that even goes into the BigNum library, because the issue there was some computations take slightly a different amount of time than other computations, and by probing this and forcing it to do computations, you could actually figure out what keys were being used. This is a real serious, potentially devastating attack. A lot of people looked at this very carefully when these timing attacks came out. But I'm getting ahead of myself. I don't want to talk about this yet. We might have time to just mention this at the end. But Redmond? Yes. Yes. Question.
Before we leave geeky implementation land, the miracle recipes in C talks about doing this kind of multiplication and division on big integers using FFT.
Yes. FFT is an alternative. FFT is fast Fourier transform. And in theory, you can get much better performance for large multiplication. In practice, no. If you look at the textbooks, you look at Knuth, for instance. Knuth will tell you, yes, FFT is the way to go. Look at Aoab, Kraft, Ullman, some of the classic textbooks. FFT works really well at the bit level. If you've got a 32-bit machine, you don't want to be tweaking things one bit at a time. Much less when we get up to a 64-bit machine. You can do it with larger blocks, but you wind up getting just eaten alive by overhead and other costs. So I don't know anybody who's actually done these implementations in practice by FFT, although it is worth mentioning. It's an interesting approach. It's another transformation, somewhat like the Montgomery transformation, a different approach, and I don't have any slides, so I can't really say much about it. You know, I guess I could get a blank page and spend 20 minutes sketching it out, but I don't think you really want me to do that. We can talk later if you want to know more. Okay, anything else? Okay, then we leave geeky implementation land and get to fundamental crypto land. And
that's even scarier.
Oh, more fun, I'd like to think. So we mentioned multiplication as a one-way function. Here's another one-way function, z equals y to the x. And this function was where public key cryptography started, this particular use. And I'll show just how it can be used as a one-way function. But let me just first, we've mentioned one-way functions a bunch of times already. Let me give you a definition, not a completely formal one, but it's as formal as I'm going to get here. Function is one-way if given its argument x, it's easy to compute y equals f of x. But given the output, the answer, y, it's difficult to find any x at all for which y equals f of x. Okay? Simple enough. An intuitive notion that turns out to be very useful. Now, you can have a family of one-way functions defined as y to the x mod n. And this family has two parameters, y and n are parameters of this function. So for any fixed y and n, you get a particular supposedly one-way function. And this is believed to be one-way for most n and y, although there are certainly exceptions. This is not a good one-way function when y is 1. Y is 1, y to the x is 1. You know, you're going to get a lot of things with the answer 1. Y is 0. N is 1. If, you know, y and n are equal, there are certainly bad cases. Okay. But no one's ever proven that any of these functions, or any function for that matter, is one-way. I'd love for somebody to do so, but I'll mention there's this problem that some people here might have heard of, P versus NP. Well, if you prove that a function is one way, as a byproduct, you'd be proving that P is different from NP. And if you know much about P versus NP, and you understand non-deterministic polynomial time, NP, that's really, this is the essence of NP, is that this is a witness. X is a witness. If you could find a witness, find a value, X, for which y equals f of x, then you're sort of finding witnesses. If you can show that finding a witness to a problem that's easily verified is hard in some case, then you've got a non-deterministic polynomial time problem, which is not polynomial time solvable. P is different from NP. Okay. Now, a little bit more math here. You can view this function, I described it as a function with one argument and two parameters that fix the function. Y and n were down here as subscripts before, and there was just one parameter, x. But if you regard this as a function of two arguments and one parameter, then it also satisfies an additional useful property, which there's no real good term for, so quasi-commutivity here. And what it says is that if you apply this function twice to the arguments in reverse order, notice the only thing I've changed here is x1, x2, x2, x1, you get the same thing. And that's certainly true in this case just because y to the power x1, x2 is the same as y to the power x2, x1. Basic math there. Okay. That said, now, that gives us enough to start doing basic public key crypto. Alice and Bob are going to make their return here. And what they want to do is establish a private channel when they are far apart. They're talking by telephone, there might be an eavesdropper, they know there might be an eavesdropper, what do they do? After all, they might be being, say, wiretapped without a court order. I didn't say that. Okay. Alice and Bob can each randomly select an integer. First, let's say they've agreed on, let's say, y and n. This is a public process. Everybody can use the same y and n, but let's say in particular, they said, let's use over the phone this y and this n. Where there's this y and n that everybody uses and everybody knows that everybody uses, that's fine. Alice selects a random large integer, little a. Bob selects a large random integer, little b. And each of them do this computation, which we spent a large part of the last hour proving they can do in a reasonable amount of time. We'll demonstrate that they can do in a reasonable amount of time. Okay? Next, they each pass the values that they computed to each other. Okay? So now, they each have the value they got from the opposite. This value B came from Bob. Alice still has her little a. She chose that at random. She can compute the value she got from Bob to this power little a. Alice can take the value that she got from Bob. Sorry, this is Bob taking the value he got from Alice. Raise it to his secret power and get a value k. Now, the way I've written them suggests that these k's should be the same. And, of course, they should be. Because b, capital B to the little a, is just y to the little b, little a, which is the same as y to the ab, which is the same as a to the b. So these values will match. They'll be equal. So, what just happened here? Alice and Bob just computed a value that they both know, but does anybody else, does anybody listening to this conversation know this value? Well, let's take a look. Let's see what Eve sees in this conversation. Eve sees the Y. She knows that this is a public value. Any N. I should have noted N here. She sees Y to the little a power. She sees Y to the little b power. The value that she's looking for, the value that Alice and Bob derived, is y to the ab. Can you, given y to the a and y to the b, compute y to the ab? I guess I better get rid of that so you can see it. But y to the ab. The answer is, nobody knows how. Nobody knows how easily. It's true. Brian points out, if you try every possible value, you can do this by brute force, but brute force is not very practical if these are 1,000-bit numbers. But if these are small numbers, yes, you can do this. So no one knows a way of computing this, and that's even if you know everything about the modulus, even if you know all its factors. There's no known way of computing this value. So Alice and Bob succeeded in exchanging a key. They were in different places. They may have had no prior communication. They're talking to each other by phone or something in some way. They established a key between themselves they can use for secret communication, even though they're talking over potentially a public channel. Everybody else could be listening to them. So I could pick out somebody in this room or pick out somebody in the back of the room in Redmond and say, okay, we're using this Y, we're using this N, pull out your calculator, you pick a value, I pick a value, we each do our calculation, okay, here's my value, here's my computed value, you give me your computed value, and then we say, okay, now we've got a key, and I, even though it's somebody I've never met before in Redmond, and everybody else is listening, I can say, okay, the answer to problem one is, but I do it encrypted with that key, and that person will understand, and everybody else is going to actually have to do the assignment, except that one person. Okay. Question?
The only thing you still haven't solved is you may not know that that person is really who they say they are.
Absolutely. There's still an authentication issue here. And yes, that's why I'm using examples like somebody in this room or somebody I can see or talking on the telephone. If you just get a message from somebody saying, I'm Alice, here's my value A, please use that. You don't know you're talking to Alice. Authentication is a very crucial, important issue. I'm not addressing it here, but yes, absolutely. We have to deal with it. And there are definitely ways of doing it, but it's well worth raising. Okay. So, it's believed that given these values, that it's difficult to compute this value. Nobody's been able to prove it. Again, this would be equivalent to proving that P is different from NP. No one has even been able to prove that it's as hard as the discrete logarithm. Now, this is different from computing discrete logarithms. If I could compute discrete logarithms, remember, is given y and y to the a mod n. Mod n is implicit in all this. It just takes too much space to write this over and over again.
Just to be clear, what E sees is y, big A, and big B.
Yeah, and big A equals that, and big B equals that. So those are the things that Eve sees in this case. So given this value and this value, computing a discrete logarithm means computing A from that. We're computing a logarithm, and the discrete part, the mod n, is implicit. If you could do that, if Eve could do that, Eve could certainly eavesdrop and figure out the key. All Eve has to do is, well, I'll take this, I'll figure out A from these two things, and now I'll raise this thing here to the eighth power, and I'll get that. No problem. So, breaking this key exchange, this Diffie-Hellman key exchange here, is certainly no harder than breaking discrete logarithms. But it's not known to be true the other way. It's possible that this could be easier. It's possible that you could, given y to the a, y to the b, and y, compute y to the a, b, and still not be able to compute discrete logs. They're believed to be probably equivalent, but nobody's been able to show that.
It doesn't scare anyone that we're using these?
Oh, it scares a lot of people. But the choice that you have, largely, comes down to this science engineering schism. The public-private key schism is we can use things that are built upon mathematical assumptions. There's no way that you can prove anything is hard in any substantive way without proving that P is different from NP. So it's a tall order. We're not likely to be able to do that. But we can use the things that have this mathematical basis and say it's based on this problem that's been studied for centuries and really believed to be hard. Or we can use the engineering approach and say, well, this thing's just a mismatch of scrambled bits here and nobody seems to be able to do anything with it, so we're going to assume it's hard. We have nothing that we can prove is unbreakable in any reasonable sense. And there's no known way with just the mishmash stuff to do this sort of a key exchange, to do some of the public key operations, this and some of the others I'll talk about. Although we do that mishmash stuff a lot. Most cryptography is that for very good reasons, performance reasons. Okay?
More? Isn't there an issue that like factorization may be easy on certain new types of computers, say, that are coming?
You're talking the quantum world, quantum computation. As far as I'm concerned, it's pretty much nonsense.
Yes, I know.
So, yes, there is an algorithm that says if you could build a quantum computer, you could factor very efficiently, very well. And people have built, with great difficulty and great expense, quantum computers that have achieved the magnificent success of factoring 15. And they may be able to do more, but there are real reasons to think there are physical barriers to think that a quantum computer with anything more than about 30 bits becomes what's called decoherent. It really can't function in any way with more than about 30 bits, and 30 bits is a pretty extreme limit. People are trying, people might be able to find some different physics and some way of doing this, but as of now, quantum computation really can't do anything in practice, And without some enormous breakthroughs, it's not likely to be. If we can build quantum computers, then yeah, we're going to have to do things very differently. But I'm worried about implementation errors a lot sooner than I'm worried about, you know, this thing breaking because of quantum computation. And there's also a whole field of quantum cryptography, which is even a little bit more questionable, let's say. You can prove things under some quantum assumptions, and there you actually can prove some difficulty in things, but it's not worth the trouble for the most part. Okay. And I have some friends who would kill me if they heard this, so this is being broadcast, but anyway. Okay, so let me move on. There are a lot of applications of this quasi-commutivity property. Key exchange is where public key cryptography started. Diffie-Hellman wrote a paper 30 years ago called New Directions in Cryptography. They introduced this, they started off a whole field, and it's done amazing things with that protocol and nothing other than, well, a little bit more than that protocol, but basically that protocol. That basic trick of quasi-commutivity has some other applications: decentralized signatures, membership testing, timestamping, some other things that can be applied to directly. I don't want to do this. If people are really interested in that, final project, maybe. Whatever. What I want to do is talk about that equation again with a slightly different form. Remember, this is the discrete root finding form, and this is not just a one-way function, it's a one-way trapdoor function because of this property. Remember that this function is hard to solve for y unless you know the factorization of n. If you know the factorization of n, you can solve it for y. And you can solve it relatively efficiently. This makes for something that's more important even, used more in practice, arguably even better than Diffie-Hellman. It was done a year after Diffie-Hellman. RSA, Ravesh Shamir and Edelman, looked at this and said, great idea. And they said, what else can we do with this? And they found something. Actually, to be technically true, Ravesh and Shamir found this, and Edelman failed to break it. So that's why his... And that sounds kind of trite, but what happened was Ravesh and Shamir came up with lots and lots of ideas, and Edelman kept breaking them. And then what finally wound up being RSA was the thing that Edelman couldn't break. So, here's how RSA works. You don't have two people anymore. It's Alice, and it can be anyone else. And what Alice can do is select two large prime numbers, P and Q, multiply them together, and publish the product. Here is my N. I know the factorization of this N, and nobody else does. So nobody else should, because I picked two large primes randomly, and unless I did a really bad job picking random primes, no one else will know what I picked. And factoring is so hard, if these primes are sufficiently large, no one else can figure it out. I know the factorization, nobody else does. Okay? What anyone can now do to send a message to Alice is to say, I want to send y. I'm going to compute y to the x mod n. And I'll send this along. I'll send the answer, and I'll tell Alice what x I'm using. That might be that Alice actually picks the x. The x might come from another source. The x doesn't matter so much here. I'll talk about that more in a moment. But basically, Alice now has z, an x, an n. Alice can figure out y. Because not only does Alice have n, Alice has p and q. Without the factors of n, anybody else watching can't do that. So we can repeat this exercise that we just did. If I pick somebody in the back of the room in Redmond, and I say, okay, pick two primes, multiply them together, tell me the product. Now I'll send you the answers to the homework by just taking the answers, of course turning them into an integer, ASCII, whatever, raising them to a certain power, which I'll tell you, or you'll know, and give you the value, and you then just take the x root. this x can even be 3 for most of the time. I can just say, I'll just cube this, you do a cube root. Nobody else is able to take cube roots, mod n. Simple enough. Okay? So Alice uses her knowledge of P and Q to compute Y, and we have a public key cryptosystem. We've built a cryptosystem where, again, I don't have to have had prior communication with anybody, and now you can have your own key that's semi-permanent, that you don't have to do a key exchange with each pair of people. But this is my key. Anybody who wants to send something to me, use this key. Okay? Now, in practice, I will mention that although x can be as small as 3, it's more typically fixed to be this precise value. And the reason for this precise value is 2 to the 16 plus 1. And if you remember doing exponentiation, square, 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 well, x here is going to be 1 and 15 zeros in 1. So you're going to have very few of these side multiplies. It's going to be 16 squares and then just one extra multiply. And there are technical reasons for this versus just 2 to the 16th. It's actually advantageous for the exponent to be a prime, and this is a prime number, and there are very few primes of the form 2 to the k plus 1. In fact, you have to go to a much, much, much larger number, way bigger than 1,000 bits, to get the next prime of this form. So this is a prime. You can use smaller numbers, but there are some disadvantages. In some, you can be a little bit careless and do some things badly if the exponent is smaller. So that's big enough to avoid some bad things that are unlikely to happen. Good. So this is almost universal. Almost everybody uses this exponent.
You could splurge and use 3 bits.
Splurge and use 3 bits?
That one has 2 1 bits in it.
Oh, yes. Yes. There are cases where you can certainly use an exponent with 3 ones rather than 2 ones, but you don't have to. This one works. It's big enough. It's prime. Everybody just uses it. You don't want something that's too big because that's extra computation. It's about the right size. It's prime, and it's become the de facto standard. Okay. I will relatively quickly go over some of the details of RSA and how it works. And basically, you may be asked to derive some of this on your own, but when n is the product of 2 primes, p and q, like that, then y to the x mod n comes back to y again. There's a certain power that you can raise y2, so that you'll get y again. And that power is, or one such power is, anytime x mod p minus 1 q minus 1 is equal to 1. Okay? So if you raise something to this power, you start with something smaller to n, and you raise it to a power with this property, you'll get back exactly what you started with. So the whole trick to RSA is to pick two numbers, E and D, which, when multiplied together, will have this property. And then RSA becomes very simple to do. Encryption is just raise Y to the eth power, and this E is the same, I'm abusing notation a little bit, the X that we had before, that the public exponent, which is almost always 65537, this D is kept secret. E times D has this property, so D of E of Y is equal to Y to the eth power to the d power, which is just Y to the ed power, and E times D has this property, so I get Y back. So the encryption is raise it to this power. The decryption is raise it to this other power, which effectively inverts it. Okay? And I don't expect you to see why that inverse works, although you could derive this on your own in the course of, say, a homework assignment, perhaps. Not that hard, actually. Okay. RSA signatures. RSA has another property that you couldn't do at all with anything like Diffie-Hellman. That was originally thought to be, this is the most important thing, this breakthrough. Multiplication is commutative. It doesn't matter whether you multiply E times D or D times Z. It's actually sort of that quasi-commutivity we had before. So if we decrypt an encryption of Y, we get Y back. If we encrypt a decryption of Y, we get Y back. We're raising it to the d power and then to the e power, but that's the same as raising it to the e power and the d power. So why would you decrypt something that hasn't been encrypted? That sounds like a strange thing. Well, let's look at what you can do with this. Only Alice, as the person with the factorization of n, knows this power, this magical power d, this decryption function. Alice can compute this y to the d, and no one else can compute something that has the property that when raised to the eth power, when encrypted, will be y. So by raising something to the dth power, Alice is effectively signing this thing y. I'm Alice, this is my public key, here's my signature on this assertion, on this check, on this whatever it is. Nobody else can compute this thing, which will verify by being encrypted to come out to Y. And you'll look and say, yeah, I guess this encrypting it with Alice's public key does come back to Y. I guess it must be Alice who did that. No one else could have. It's a very powerful property. So, what can you do now? Well, one simple thing that we could think about doing is creating a public key directory, much like a telephone directory, for everybody, or a DNS table, a large directory, where everybody has their public key, and you register your public key somehow with the phone company, or with somebody who is maintaining the DNS tables for some organization, or whatever, and you know, okay, Alice's public key is this, and Bob's public key is that, and Carol's public key is that, and it goes on and on, and we could just assume they're all using the same exponent, E65537, whatever. And then, if you want to encrypt something for that person, you look up their public key, even though you've never met them before, and you send it them the thing, they can decrypt it, no problem, no prior communication. If you want to sign something, you use your signature, and anybody can check your signature because they know, they can look up, this is so-and-so's public key, this thing must have been signed by so-and-so because that so-and-so's public key actually does verify it. When you encrypt, you do get back this reasonable-looking thing. Okay. So E is, yes, sorry, I said that, E is commonly fixed to 65537. Another thing you can do is use the signature property. If there is somebody that everybody trusts in some way, and it doesn't have to be just one person, but it can be many, then even if I don't know Alice, Alice can go to this trusted authority and say, will you please sign a statement to the effect that my key is this? And this authority, if they're doing their job very well, will go and check Alice's identification very carefully and make sure it really is Alice and look at this public key and say, okay, I will sign the statement that says, Alice, this is your public key. The primary company that does this is VeriSign. They also they bought Network Associates, Network Solutions, who did who runs the .com domain. So now they've got control of .com and .org and a few other of the big domains, I think. They're actually a spinoff of RSA, of the RSA company. They can do these signatures. Their public key is baked into everybody's browser. So you, with your browser, can verify a certificate that they have signed of some store, say Amazon, which says, okay, you want to buy something at Amazon, here is the public key to use to send your credit card, essentially. I'm skipping a few steps, but you get the idea. Here's the key you use to send your credit card, and see, it's signed by VeriSign, so you know it's got to be my key, and it's really Amazon. It's all really true. Now, Amazon has occasionally signed keys that they shouldn't have.
VeriSign.
I said Amazon? Oh, no. I don't want to blame Amazon, even though Amazon was using SSL2 forever, so it wouldn't have made a difference. But anyway, VeriSign, a few years ago, a very famous case, signed some random person, said, I'm Microsoft, please sign these keys. And they did. nobody knows who that was to this day. These keys never seem to have been used. They got enough publicity or something, whatever. But it did cause some headaches. Okay. So
they've also admit third party, they've allowed a lot of third parties to start becoming CAs, and you get less trustworthy people selling stuff.
There are actually, VeriSign is not the only CA. There are lots more CAs, and there are political issues with what CAs are legitimate and what aren't, and you get to the national politics of what CAs' public keys get baked into a browser or not. The Bolivian post office says this: we're going to be a CA. Do you want to offend Bolivia? This is the sort of situation you get into. Question?
If E is fixed, isn't it somewhat complicated to compute E?
It turns out not to be. It's a perfectly good question. It turns out that it's actually quite simple to compute a modular inverse. So what you're really doing is computing the inverse of D, or of E, sorry, of this fixed E mod this P minus 1, Q minus 1 factor. You get an inverse of that, and that's something that when multiplied by E will get you 1. So yes, you shouldn't feel that you should know how to do that at this point. I haven't told you how to do it, but it turns out to be quite simple. It's a very straightforward computation. And that's something that also we can talk about, or maybe might work its way into an assignment to show how to do that. So tough. Okay. You can even have trust chains that go beyond this. So it's not just necessarily VeriSign says, I'm Amazon, but Amazon can then say, okay, well, Amazon signs something that says, you're employee number 326 at Amazon, and then I would verify, well, this key supposedly comes from employee 326 at Amazon. I will check that this is really Amazon's key. Well, okay, this is signed by a key that's supposedly Amazon's key, and this supposedly Amazon's key is signed by VeriSign. And I believe VeriSign, maybe, so I'll believe that, or not. But you can have a whole chain of trust that way. Now, you can get, trust questions that come up. If I trust Alice, should I accept a key? Alice says that's Bob, Bob says that's Carol. How far does this go? I don't know. So trust decisions can become somewhat complicated here. Okay, let me talk a little bit about authentication. I've got a few minutes to just start on that, and get into some issues that show where things start to get complicated. So, how can you use RSA to prove your identity? This came up when we were talking about Diffie-Hellman. And now we can think about, well, maybe I've got a certificate on my Diffie-Hellman key sign that says, this is my Diffie-Hellman value, something like that. You certainly can do that with an RSA value. Why not a Diffie-Hellman value? Well, if I want to just know that I'm talking to a certain person, what I might do is try something simple. If Alice's public key is a certain thing, I just pick a random message, send it to Alice, and tell Alice, decrypt it. If you can decrypt it, then you must be Alice. Right? Well, this works very well for authentication. If it can be decrypted, yeah, it probably is Alice. Is Alice going to want to do this? Well, you get into problems, right? M comes back, I must be talking to Alice. But should Alice be happy with doing this? Maybe the message that Bob sent was, I owe Bob $1 million, signed Alice. Please decrypt this for me. Well, a decryption is a digital signature. Now, there are ways of disambiguating the two and separating them, but in the raw form, it's just a digital signature. So, Bob sends this, Alice decrypts it, so Alice signs that, now Bob goes to the bank, ha-ha! So, you want to be a little bit more careful in this. So, if Alice only returns authentication queries that have a certain form, she says, wait a minute, I'll check this. If this is an ASCII string that says, I owe you $1 million, I'm not going to decrypt it, because that'll be signing it. So maybe Alice is a little bit more careful, but RSA has multiplicative properties that can be taken advantage of. So note that encryption and decryption are multiplicative. If you go through the RSA equation, the decryption of one value times the decryption of another value is equal to the decryption of the product of the values. So if I've decrypted or signed this value and this value, I've effectively decrypted or signed the product of these values. So this might look innocuous and that might look innocuous, but I might have chosen these two things such that their product is something that says, I owe you $1 million. So it's not so simple. There are a lot of subtleties that come about. I'm going to mention another subtlety quickly. I've got just a few more to go through. The Hostet attack. It turns out that if you encrypt the same value identically, without any randomness, without any changes, for multiple people, if you encrypt it for enough people, they can compute the value. Anybody watching can compute the value. And this is basically just the Chinese remaindering trick that we talked about earlier. So if I know x cubed mod n1, x cubed mod n2, and x cubed mod n3, I can compute x directly.
So like if I sent an email to a huge list of people, each with their public key, it would become easier and easier.
Well, if you're doing very simple using raw RSA, if you send it to enough people, yes. However, no one should ever use raw RSA. You should put some randomness into each instantiation, each encryption to avoid this. So this is just sort of a high level beware of kind of thing. Just trying to point out some of the things that can go wrong. But yes, that would be a problem. And this, in fact, is the principal reason why we don't use 3 as an exponent. We use 65537 because the Hostet attack works for such a small value here. We'd say, okay, let's use 65537. And then, in effect, you'd have to send the message to more than 65,000 people. And face it, you know, a secret among 65,000 people is not a secret anyway. So that's not going to be a problem. Okay. The Blackenbacher attack, I will mention very quickly because we're just about out of time. Not quite, but close. There was a format that was used to designate all encrypted messages that you should do the following with. You should take your message here, you should put zeros in front of the message, a byte of zeros, and you should put some random stuff up here, and you should put this designator up here, and this should be what a message will look like. Any valid message that's encrypted will look like this. Well, it turns out that this message format is susceptible to a certain very well-targeted attack. This format doesn't have any redundancy in it, and it has some other properties, where the zeros are and whatnot, that it turned out that if you see messages encrypted in this way and you generate them, you can actually decrypt the message of your choosing with some effort. So you have some message you want to decrypt. What I do is I send other things derived from this message, and I can figure out, based on the behavior of who I send it to, perhaps what the message is. And the way that this worked, this came up 9-10 years ago, something like this, this was during the age of the browser wars between Netscape and Microsoft. And just to give you the quick background on this, Netscape had a much friendlier implementation of this protocol than Microsoft had. If you used if a Netscape server received something in a bad format, what it would do is say, oh, I received a misformatted message. I didn't see a zero where I was supposed to, or something like that. Well, that information turned out to be very helpful for an attacker. Microsoft implementation at the time, due honestly to just dumb luck, was a lot less friendly, didn't give that information, and that information turned out to be key to being able to figure out exactly what a message was, be able to decrypt by just sort of piecing together little bits. And again, something to research a little bit if you're interested more. It's basically taking advantage of the multiplicative properties of RSA. There are man-in-the-middle attacks, which these things are susceptible to. Eve sitting between Alice and Bob, telling Alice, I'm Bob, telling Bob, I'm Alice, and intercepting everything in the middle. These are things to be worried about, has to be dealt with. And there's the practical stuff. So I promise to say this, so I'll say this as we wrap up. RSA can be used to encrypt any data. In practice, you don't. Public key cryptography, asymmetric cryptography, the scientific side of cryptography, is very inefficient compared to the engineering side, symmetric private key, the traditional stuff that's been done for centuries, for millennia. Take this thing, DES as was mentioned, take this thing, scramble, use the key in this way, done. That's orders of magnitude faster. So in practice, we use public key for the things that only public key can be done for, and we use symmetric key stuff everywhere else. So what we typically do is, for efficiency, we use RSA or some similar public key algorithm to transmit a symmetric key, and then from then on, all the private data is sent with that key that's been exchanged, that session key, using symmetric cryptographic methods. Okay, digital signatures are used not to sign an entire message, but to sign just a digest, a shortened form of that message, for efficiency and to keep things. Did I lose something? No, I guess not. To keep things manageable, that works much better that way. So, next week we're going to start getting more into this practical side. How do you do this symmetric encryption? How do you do the symmetric stuff? But this gives a broad overview of the symmetric side of things. Now, I don't even remember exactly where we're going next week. So, but I don't know. We got to figure this out. But anyway, that's it for tonight. The website is not up yet. There will be an assignment posted. It should be up tomorrow. There will be other course information that should be up tomorrow. And the assignment needs to be in at the beginning of class, either in Redmond or here, next Tuesday night. Question?
Will there be information about, like, TAs, contact for help?
Yep. All that. We have the TAs. We just need to get all the names up on the site. Let me ask, though, as a procedural matter, are people interested in TA office hours? Would this be something that you take advantage of?
Email.
Yes?
The email.
Email. Okay. So you don't need physically, I would think that for PMP students especially, physically coming in and talking to a TA is just not the practical way.
Previous classes, TAs that have lived on the email system have been much more helpful.
Okay. So we'll set that up, and you can also email us. And our addresses, we have UW addresses, we also have Microsoft addresses. The Microsoft addresses are a lot easier and more reliable for us. So we'll post those, but you can email any of us at any time, and we'll be happy to answer questions and try to keep things moving.
Do you expect there will be a course email list?
I expect so. Actually, Fred, do you know what's the standard? A course email list. Is that a standard?
Yeah, it's a standard feature.
Okay.
It already exists, probably.
It probably exists. We've got. If this class were on Thursday after New Year's instead of Tuesday after New Year's, we'd have all that worked out. But we're just.
Want people to subscribe to it?
Is that?
Do we, how it's normally done?
Yeah.
So there will be a course email list. We'll put the information on the website on how to subscribe.
Yeah.
Yeah.
People have been in these classes before.
Josh.
Usually the course email list takes a week or two to get straightened out. Don't feel bad.
Okay. Thank you. I appreciate that little grace, the period, and I will try to get things to happen, but yeah, especially just, you know, even the website. The website is rudimentary information. We don't even have the syllabus up yet. We don't have the course information, and we don't have the first problem set up yet. But that'll be up shortly, and we'll see you all next week, I guess. Either here or in Redmond. Some of us will be in one, some of us will be in the other. Thank you.